Agricultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division and the Natural Resources Finance Division will come to order. The first item on tonight's agenda is the presentation of the Natural Resources Land Report by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. It is very important that both committees hear the presentation for this very important report. And as a since it was scheduled before we got our targets and our deadlines for the budget, settling of the budget bill, Representative Wagenius and I decided to go to continue with the agenda item. But tomorrow from 9:30 to 10, Representative Wagenius's committee is going to hear rebuttals and questions on this report. Mr. Nobles, thank you for coming and making your presentation, and Mr. Yonker, thank you for your evaluation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota. With me at the table is John Yonker, who was the manager of this evaluation. Also in the audience is Carrie Meyerhoff, just behind us, who was a member of the evaluation team. And I'd also like to point out that for this evaluation, we had the benefit of a member of House Research, Colby Sullivan, who Mr. McCormick was gracious enough to loan to us. And I thank Pat McCormick and Colby Sullivan for the contribution that was made to this evaluation. Madam Chair and members, I think we would all agree that the people of Minnesota enjoy a wide range of benefits from state-owning natural resource land and purchasing conservation easements on private land. State ownership of land and easements provides opportunities for hunting, fishing, boating, canoeing, hiking, camping, picnicking, trail riding, rock climbing, and a host of other recreational activities. State ownership of land and easements also helps protect and conserve habitat, endangered species, and the simple beauty of the Minnesota landscape. And in some cases, state ownership of land produces revenue for the state treasury and for local units of government. But providing these benefits obviously costs money. And those costs extend far beyond the initial purchase price of land and easements. The state does not own land or easement just to have a portfolio of real estate. It owns land and easements as part of programs. And managing those programs and the land and easements associated with those programs costs money. For example, it costs money to develop a park, maintain a wildlife management area, monitor tree growth, and enforce easements. The state also incurs costs by making payments to local governments for the estimated negative impact of state land ownership on the budgets of local units of government. Because the costs are significant and because there are competing perspectives on how state land and easements should be used, natural resource land as a topic can become controversial. And where there is controversy, there is often a request to the Legislative Audit Commission to authorize the Office of the Legislative Auditor to conduct an evaluation, and that occurred last year. We would be the first to admit that this was a very challenging assignment. It is a big topic, and there are a lot of issues involved. Early on, we decided we could not evaluate all of the individual programs associated with state land ownership and easements. We had to look broadly at how DNR is managing its land holdings and how DNR and Bowser are managing their easements. And because there was strong legislative interest, we also assessed in some depth the issues related to state payments in lieu of taxes to local units of government. So, Madam Chair and members, with that, I would like to turn to Mr. Yonker to tell you more about what we found and what we recommend. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Yonker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is John Yonker. I was the project manager for our study of natural resource land. I'd like to walk you through our little slide presentation about the report. First, I'm going to highlight some of the key findings and give you a little background on state-owned natural resource land, and then talk about the findings in more detail. There are four main findings in the report kind of mirror the four chapters of the report and the four main areas we looked at. First of all, we found that DNR has made some efforts to strategically evaluate its land holdings, but we feel that there's more work needed in the future. We looked also at easement programs, both at DNR and at the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and we feel that DNR lacks a comprehensive easement management program, but they're currently developing one. We also looked at the question with all of the interest in acquiring land and certainly heightened expectations from the for acquiring more land from the passage of the Legacy Amendment. We looked at the question of whether DNR has adequate resources to manage and maintain existing land, and what we found was that they appear to lack adequate resources for managing and maintaining their existing properties. And finally, we were asked to take a look at the issue of payments in lieu of taxes, which is almost a study in and of itself. And what we found is that for a variety of reasons, I'll get into them in detail, the adequacy of PILT is difficult to assess. But it would appear that most counties receive more than is necessary to offset lost property tax revenue for acquired non-hunting land, and that's a specific type of land. A little bit of background about state-owned natural resource land. There's about 8.4 million acres of that of natural resource land that the state owns. That's about one-sixth of the land in the state. That includes 5.6 million acres managed by DNR. That's typically what you think of as the DNR's land. Then there are another 2.8 million acres that are tax-forfeited land held in trust for local governments. These are managed by the counties, and those tax-forfeited lands are primarily, though not exclusively, forested lands that are managed for timber and other purposes, including recreation. If you focus on the 5.6 million acres, this is the DNR land, about two-thirds of it is forest, state forests or other forested lands. Almost a quarter is wildlife management areas or other wildlife properties. And this is all in terms of acreage, as the percentage of acres represented by each of these areas. 4% of the acres are parks and state parks and state recreation areas. 3% are scientific and natural areas. And the other 1% includes all the other properties, including state trails, water access sites, aquatic management areas, and others. Again, looking at DNR's land, I think it helps to understand how DNR acquired or got this land. 45% of the land that DNR manages is school trust fund land that is managed, and the net proceeds are given to the K-12 education system. This is what's remaining of the land that the federal government gave the state back in the 19th century around the time of statehood. And so basically this is land that DNR has not gone out and acquired. This is what's remaining of the land we were given. Another 28% of the land are consolidated conservation lands, or CONCON lands for short. These lands were acquired by the state in the 1920s and 30s, and they came into the state's possession when counties had tried to, these were tax forfeited lands that the counties tried to drain. They issued bonds to drain them and make them productive, primarily for agricultural purposes. They were unsuccessful in doing that. They were defaulting on the bonds. A few counties were in danger of bankruptcy. The state took over the bond payments and in return assumed control of the lands. And currently on ConCon lands, there is part of the proceeds of the ConCon lands are distributed to local governments where these lands are. If you look at DNR's, so that's the land that DNR manages. If you look at those types of lands and you look at the long-range plans that either DNR or citizen advisory groups have put together, there are some fairly significant long-range plans to acquire more land. For wildlife management areas, the citizens advisory group report recommends a 64% increase in the number of acres. For scientific and natural areas, a 240% increase in sites, and you can go down and read all of these and see that except for forests, there are pretty significant increases that are in those long-range plans. If you look at how much land has DNR managed land has changed over the last 20 years, you would see a little different story. It's only grown very modestly. So over a 20-year period, there's only been about a 5% increase in the amount of in the number of acres that DNR manages. Most of the growth is in wildlife areas, some in scientific and natural areas and state parks, and I think there's been about no change or even a small reduction in the amount of forested land. Going back to the tax forfeited land, the 2.8 million acres I referenced before that's managed by the counties, that hasn't changed much over the last 20 years. There are always pressures on DNR to both buy land and acquire easements, as well as to sell or exchange land. And I won't get into all of the details. I think you're familiar with them. I'll just reference the fact that back in 2003 and 2005, state laws were passed requiring DNR to sell some land, the net proceeds of which were to go to the general fund. And it wasn't just DNR, it was other state agencies. The requirement for 2005 was to sell $6.4 million worth of land or properties, and out of that, I think about $3.8 million has been sold. DNR has contributed about $2.2 million of that total. So obviously there have been some pressures to sell land, reevaluate land holdings. There have also been counties, particularly in northern Minnesota, that have passed resolutions asking that there be no net increase in public land holdings. That's not just DNR, but it would also include federal land. What we saw is that DNR has made efforts to identify land for sale and certainly, as I indicated, has sold some land. They also have $8.4 million of land up for sale right now. The market isn't particularly good, so they have not all the land that's been offered has been selling. And there are other reasons why it hasn't necessarily sold, which we get into in the report. Besides that, DNR has been conducting a pilot project with Roseau County, looking at how they can cooperate with a county and look at where it's to their mutual advantage to sell land, acquire land, exchange land with the county, and so on. And finally, at the end of 2009, DNR completed some forestry plans that look at strategic asset management for the forests and try to set priorities for acquisition, sales, and exchanges. We don't think the work is complete. Obviously, as I said, the sales have not produced the required proceeds. Another concern that we raise in the report is that if you look in northern Minnesota, you have a checkerboard pattern sometimes of public forest ownership. You can have a big tract of county tax forfeited land, which is forested, with a small parcel in the middle of it or somewhere within it that is state-owned, or you can have a large state parcel with a little bit of county land in it. And there could be reasons for retaining that small parcel of state land, but I think there are also reasons sometimes for its changing land with the counties, and that's something that needs to be worked on. There are other issues that we raise in the report about where we think that there needs to be some additional work. Conservation easements are also purchased by DNR and by, as I said, by Bowser on private land. For DNR, the programs that do conservation easements include trout streams, aquatic easements, wild and scenic rivers, Native Prairie Bank, Forest Legacy. And Bowser has a basically uses RIM easements on a variety of different programs. Basically, these conservation easements preserve natural resource land by limiting certain development or other rights of the private landowner. But the important thing for public agencies is that to do good management of these easements, you can't just buy the easement and let it sit. You need to do initial and ongoing work in order to protect the public investment. And that means that you maintain an inventory of easements. You do a baseline report when you acquire the easement that documents what the conditions of the land are at the time. And then you do periodic monitoring and enforcement to make sure that the landowner is living up to the agreement. What we found is that Bowser has a comprehensive program. They have policies, rules, and regulations that deal with those issues. DNR, we feel, has not had an agency-wide program. It has managed some easements better than others. DNR is currently developing, however, a comprehensive program with help from a legislative grant that came initially through the LCCMR. And through this grant, they're compiling an inventory of their easements, which has been needed, and they're developing policies for baseline reports and monitoring. So now I'm going to go to the next issue, and that's funding for existing DNR lands. What we found is that DNR appears to lack adequate resources to manage and maintain their existing land holdings. The deficiencies include the lack of initial development work, deferred rehabilitation work, and that could be on park buildings, could be on state trails, it could be on, it is on water access sites and fishing piers and so on. And they also lack adequate funding for periodic maintenance or operations. It wasn't possible for us to quantify the overall extent of the shortfalls without a lot of additional work. And here are some of the examples we found of backlogs or shortfalls at DNR in terms of funding to manage existing land. For scientific and natural areas, there's a backlog of $7.6 million, and so on. And let me just highlight the wildlife management areas, because that's a case where there's an unknown backlog. And DNR really needs a better management information system to document what the conditions are in its wildlife management areas and what their needs are. What we recommend in the report is that DNR should prepare long-range budget analyses that compare ongoing funding needs to existing funding levels. If you recall, the 2009 legislature required that DNR do this for parks and trails, and they prepared that analysis, was ultimately delivered in November 2009, and I think in your committee's House Fiscal Staff, Jim Reinholz from House Fiscal Staff, has prepared a spreadsheet that has looked at how you could address some of these backlogs of rehabilitation work in parks and trails while at the same time doing some acquisition over time. And I think those analyses are very useful and are the kinds of things that we would hope would be done once the DNR prepares these long-range budget analyses. So we also talk about in the report how we think that once these analyses are prepared, the legislature should review them and also take a look at how DNR is defining their needs, because needs may be wants as well as needs, and you may not agree with them, or they may not even agree internally as to what their needs are. So I think it's important that there be a thorough review of that. And finally, as I indicated, DNR needs to quantify what their overall management needs are for wildlife management areas, and in particular, they need a management information system to do that. As I mentioned, these long-range budget analyses are needed for almost all land uses except parks and trails. We think they will help the legislature better understand the ongoing costs of land ownership and help the legislature ultimately balance funding for acquisitions with funding for ongoing management and maintenance. I'm going to move on now to the last area, payments in lieu of taxes. This gets to be a pretty complicated area, so forgive me if I make it too complicated. I'll certainly be willing to answer questions when we get done with the presentation. There was about $22 million in PILT that was paid in 2009. This was distributed by law mostly to counties and townships, but there's an exception to that, and that is for acquired hunting lands, and that's land that's in WMAs. They're distributed because the distribution is under an older law. It's distributed to counties, townships, and school districts. When the legislature implemented the PILT laws in 1979, they didn't change this older law, which applied to hunting lands. The payment rates for state land are quite variable. They're the highest for acquired DNR lands, and that is lands that were on the tax rolls when they were acquired by DNR, and also for certain CONCON lands. Specifically, CONCON lands that are in state parks, scientific and natural areas, and in the wildlife management areas, I believe, are in this acquired category, and the reason the legislature put them there is because, as I said before, local governments get a share of the proceeds from CONCON lands, but there aren't significant proceeds from lands that are in those three types of properties. The payment rates for the payment rate for DNR acquired land is either the greater of, for any county, it's the greater of $5.11 per acre, or 75% of appraised value. 74 counties get the 75.75% of appraised value. They use the valuation method. 13 counties, it's to their advantage to use $5.11 per acre because the value of that property is less than elsewhere around the state. However, the payment rate is significantly less for other types of land. So for other DNR administered state land, school trust fund land, the other CONCON land that may be forested or certainly not in those three types of properties that I mentioned, only receives 64 cents per acre. And then finally, and let me say also that, you know, one of the reasons for the difference here is because those lands, school trust fund lands, never came off the tax rolls. So the argument with acquired land is it should get a higher value, a higher PILT payment, because that was land that was removed from the tax rolls, and you're presumably trying to replace the property taxes that were lost when the state acquired the property. Finally, the county-managed tax-forfeited land receives $1.28 per acre. Keep in mind that counties manage that land primarily for timber, and so they're receiving some net proceeds from that land in most years. If you look at the trends in PILT, and I would ask you if you've got a copy of the report to take a look at page 61, because I don't have the graph here on the slide. If you look at page 61, It kind of tracks the actual PILT payments per acre and how they've changed since the PILT law was enacted in 1979 and first put in effect in 1980, and looks at that relative to inflation. And what you can see is that between 1980 and 2000, PILT payments did not keep up with inflation. And so what happened is the legislature made a number of changes, and what they did was they indexed the dollar amounts paid for per acre for inflation going forward, and they adjusted those dollar amounts upward to reflect the inflation that had occurred since 1994. So basically, they've protected them now from inflation, although not between 1980 and 1994. What also happened was some of that Concon land was placed in the acquired category, and also the valuation method was put in the statute. It hadn't been there during the much of that time period. So what most people see is that PILT has been growing very, very fast. In fact, between 2000 and 2009, it's almost tripled due to those legislative changes, due to the growth in land values. So now if you look at 2009 PILT per acre, it's about 30% higher than in 1980 when you adjust for inflation. And that's the in the figure, that's the actual payment of $2.84 per acre compared to $2.16 would be inflation. It's important to note, though, that counties differ in terms of how much acquired land they've got and how much they have that's in these categories that receive lower payments. So there are some counties for which PILT has not kept up with inflation over this longer time period because they primarily contain not acquired land. What we were asked to do was take a look at PILT and answer the question of whether or not PILT was adequate, more than adequate, less than adequate. What's the right amount of PILT? It's not an easy question. And so you can ask yourself, are there any criteria for determining the adequacy of PILT? The problem is state law really doesn't provide much guidance as to what PILT is supposed to do. You could probably guess that PILT is probably intended to offset the fiscal impacts of state land ownership on local governments. But the law is not specific about what those fiscal impacts might be. We tried to list in the report what some of those fiscal impacts would be, and some of these are more applicable to some types of land and less applicable to others. So, for example, as I talked about before, lost property tax revenue is probably most relevant to acquired land, land that had come off the tax rolls, and it's not relevant to school trust fund land and some Concon land. I can skip down to the third item here. The cost of local government services is probably a more relevant consideration for trust fund land. What are the costs of providing local government services, which could be roads or bridges or emergency services, to that land? You're not trying to replace the property tax revenues. You're just trying to provide some compensation to local governments for those costs. There are lots of other considerations here. There are some increased state aids that occur when the state acquires land. It does trigger an increase in state aid, county program aid. It would trigger an increase potentially in the LGA that cities receive, and it can affect school district revenue and state aids to school districts. I'm going to highlight the last item here, and that's state lands probably also have an economic impact on local governments in those areas because they generate some tourism, but the amount of tourism and the economic impact is going to vary a lot depending on the type of property and its use. And once it has an economic effect, then it probably also has some effect on local government finances. Let me just say that there are, we face some difficulties in assessing the adequacy of PILT because there really aren't any data out there that measure the impact of state land acquisitions or state land ownership on local government costs. You have great difficulty trying to assess the economic impacts and their effect on local government finances. So we didn't even attempt to try to measure those things. What we did look at was somewhat narrow, but it focused in on the acquired land, and in particular We looked at how PILT compares to the estimated property taxes lost when DNR acquires land. And that's what I'm going to mention today. If you look at the PILT for acquired non-hunting land, and in this particular case, the PILT only goes, as I mentioned before, only goes to counties and towns and not school districts for non-hunting land. PILT is on average 64% higher for newly acquired land than the county-town taxes it's trying to replace. Now, bear in mind, this is a state-wide average. It doesn't apply to each and every township, each and every county. What we've done is average within counties and then average across counties to get a statewide average. So tax rates vary across the state. Some jurisdictions might actually have higher taxes than the PILT, but there aren't that many of them in this particular comparison. Because state land is reappraised only once every 5 years, and private land is reappraised potentially every year, the difference that you see in the first year of acquisition can be narrowed over time if land values are increasing, because that private, that land would have been if it remained in private hands, its taxes might have been going up if land values were going up, and its taxes would have been going down if land values were going down. So the 64% applies to the first year of acquisition. And then what happens subsequent to that until the next reappraisal of public land depends on how land values are changing. We looked at also at who is the main beneficiary of the difference between PILT and taxes. And what we found is that counties are the main beneficiary of this difference. The reason is that townships, on average, we estimate, are only getting about 2.5% of the PILT for acquired non-hunting land, whereas town taxes are about 19 to 20% of the combined county-town taxes across the state. Obviously, they vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from county to county, but these are statewide averages. What's happened here is that the original PILT law said, remember I said the payment for acquired land was $5.11 or 0.75% of the value of the land. Originally, the law said $3 per acre and townships were to get 30 cents. What the legislature did subsequently was index those dollar amounts for inflation, so now the $3 became $5.11. And the 30 cents for townships became 51 cents. But in 74 counties, the valuation method is used, and townships there still get 51 cents per acre. So on a statewide basis, the payment of PILT per acre averages about $21 per acre. And the townships are getting, on average, 51 cents. So 2.5% of the total. So this brings up some issues, I think, for the legislature. And you know, we're not trying to say what you should do or make some specific recommendations, because I think these are subject to the issue of what are you trying to do with PILT. And as I said, the laws aren't very specific. One issue is PILT for acquired non-hunting lands too high? Another issue, following on what I just said, is should townships get a greater share of PILT for acquired non-hunting lands? There's also an issue of whether cities should be eligible for PILT if the land is in a city and not a township, although I'm not sure there are a lot of cities where there is state land. There's at least one, Taylor's Falls, that has some very significant costs in connection with interstate state park, and they don't receive PILT. It goes to the county instead. The state has tried to make an adjustment in the LGA formula for Taylor's Falls, but I'm not sure that it's been successful as a PILT payment would be in addressing those costs. Finally, an issue could be raised about what's the role of school districts in all of this. School districts get PILT for acquired hunting lands. they don't get TILT for most other properties, including acquired non-hunting lands. An argument could be made that school districts don't need TILT. The argument would go along these lines. You really want to ask, how are school districts affected by state land purchases? And I think you could argue that for the most part, school district revenues are not affected. That basically school districts are going to get the same amount of money through state aid or local taxes regardless of whether the state buys land in that jurisdiction, in that school district or not. You could argue, though, that the impact on school, there could be an impact on school property tax rates. And that could affect potentially voters' willingness to pass a referendum. So there's how you might make the link. Are school district tax rates affected by land purchases? Yes and no. Tax rates for debt service levies may increase slightly if DNR purchases land in a school district. Tax rates for operating levies may or may not be affected. The land that DNR probably most likely purchases, that would be ag non-homestead land or non-commercial seasonal recreational property or a portion of the ag homestead property, would not be affected by state land purchases because that land is not taxed for purposes of the operating referendum levies that school districts impose. The portion of ag homestead that's represented by the house, the garage, and 1 acre of land is taxed for those purposes. It is subject to referendum operating levies, so if that was part of a DNR land purchase, tax rates could be affected to the extent that that was a factor. It gets very complicated, Madam Chair, and so it's very hard to give you a definite answer on some of these things, but it gives you a flavor of how complicated the TILT area is. We'd be happy, that concludes the presentation, we'd be happy to answer any questions that the committees have.
We still have 5 minutes left in the time period that I've allotted, so we can have questions for 5 minutes, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going, when you referenced page 61, I was going back to the start of that chapter to see if there's history. Why we decided as a state to do payment in lieu of taxes for natural resource land and not other state government removal of land from the tax rolls. Why that one narrow decision? Am I missing it here? Do we know the history?
Mr. Yunker.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, we really don't get into that issue in the report, and I don't know that I could answer that question for you. The decision to pay TILT for natural resource land was made back in 1979, so it's a little hard to know what the legislative history was behind that. I do know that there was it was LCMR at that time. There was an LCMR report that looked at kind of the fiscal impacts on different types of land. They actually threw up their hands and said they couldn't really measure it for natural resource land, but they did some measurement for other types of properties like DNR district offices or state universities, colleges, a variety of other state-owned properties. But it wasn't clear exactly why the recommendation was to do TILT only for natural resource land.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have two quick questions. How did
one.
The one? Okay, one quick question. Yes, ma'am. How did the DNR propose promote the sales of these lands?
Mr. Yunker.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I'm not sure what the question is.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, they have a website. They put up signage when they mark land for sale. They do a variety of things. And it's my understanding that DNR will be back at some point to talk to you or to Representative Wagenius's committee. And I know that at the Legislative Audit Commission hearing, they had the person who's in charge of that give quite a lengthy discussion. But basically, they make a public declaration through their website and at the local land site as well.
Thank you.
Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know Representative McNamara owns land in my district that we can't use for an operating levy, and other folks like him, former Representative Earhart, but that's for another day. Since I only have one question, I'll try to frame it so I get two answers. The first is, who appraises the state land? And up in my district, property is appraised about every 5 years. And you're saying that state land is appraised once every 5 years. I don't see any difference there at all. And I don't see why PILT wouldn't increase the same amount as it does on my home or on a resort or on a commercial facility.
Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair, state law requires and specifies that the state land, natural resource land that on which PILT payments are made, only be reappraised every 5 years. Because typically, assessors don't appraise public property because it doesn't pay taxes. So the argument is, I suppose, something about resources and how frequently we should be appraising land that on which taxes aren't paid.
Who appraises it? The county assessor?
Ms. Gianker.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's appraised by the county assessors.
We'll have a talk with the county assessor.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question. Did you request, and if so, how did you request input from fish wildlife conservation groups?
Ms. Gianker.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, we primarily worked with DNR and certainly talked with their fish and wildlife, and forestry, and their ecological resources divisions. We didn't spend much time at all talking with conservation groups. The report does not take a position on how much acquisition should be done, or we really feel that's a legislative decision, and all we're recommending in this report is simply that more information would be beneficial to the legislature, more information in particular on what the long-range budget picture is and what the long-range budget needs are for existing land.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to that.
Mr. Nobles.
We felt that we wanted to use our resources to do something that others couldn't do. And we think this committee and other legislative committees and in the Senate are quite capable and often do hold hearings to hear from a wide range of conservation, fishing, hunting groups. Many of them are probably here in this room and will testify later. But we're quite familiar with the venues at which they bring forth their perspectives. We thought our task was somewhat more technical in terms of gathering data and doing analysis. But our door was certainly open to anyone who wanted to contact us, and we never turn anyone down who requests to speak to us.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Noble or Mr. Yonker, whichever. The assessor is doing appraisals. When DNR purchases land, how many appraisals need to be made? And is the county involved in that? And also, what would the PILT payment be for Vermilion State Park?
Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair, I didn't quite get the first question. How many appraisals?
Madam Chair, yeah, how many appraisals have to be done if DNR is going to purchase land?
Ms. Gianker.
Madam Chair, we didn't get into that in detail, so I'm not sure I want to hazard a guess as to that. I know that DNR does have appraisals done on land. and often you may have the, you could even have the seller of the land having their own appraisal. And if there's more than one appraisal, DNR has a process where they hire someone to like take a look at the appraisals and see which appraisal seems to be the best. So, and I'm more describing the process for Lake Vermilion, so it may not be quite so detailed on some other purchases, but you asked what the PILT payments are for Lake Vermilion. That's a separate law that was passed, I believe, in 2008, and they are essentially twice the usual rate for acquired land, or 1.5% of the value. And they're distributed a little differently. They're distributed, I think, one-third each to the county, township, and school district.
Page 58, Representative Erdahl, the bottom. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, for either one of you. So you didn't take into account the constituents that we've heard from in their desire to have more land available for them for public recreation and the pressure that puts on the DNR to work it within their infrastructure, because in the last 5 years, we've allocated a lot of money for land purchase, and now with the sales tax amendment.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, we are obviously aware of those interests and those pressures. We referred to some of the plans that DNR has put forth. They've been put forth in large part by some of those interest groups that you referenced. We also obviously read the paper and attend various legislative hearings to understand what those interests are, and we've also done other evaluations. For example, several years ago we did an evaluation of the parks system and dealt a lot with people who wanted an expansion of the park system and of the trails as well. We did an evaluation some years ago of the motorized vehicle trail issue and certainly understood the enormous pressure that is out there, or at least was at the time, for people who wanted DNR to provide more recreational opportunities for people who wanted to utilize motorized vehicles. So I think without necessarily, again, trying to go down the very long list of people who potentially we might or you might wanted us to contact, and I think that was another reason, is that, as you well know, there are literally, I would say, hundreds of these organizations representing a great diversity and sometimes conflicting interests. And so if we'd started down that road of selecting people to talk to, I think we would have spent most of our time in those kinds of conversations rather than doing the analysis that we were asked to do.
Thank you very much. The time has drawn to a close for that we have allotted for this. Tomorrow morning at 9:30 in Environment Finance, Commissioner Holston is going to be the first person to speak to the legislative report, and then there will be opportunities for questions from committee members for both committees from 9:30 to 10 tomorrow. Representative Wagenius.
Your nameplates will be up for both committees, so we certainly want to make sure you come. But secondly, we will have an open mic for folks from the public to testify to.
And for Cultural and Outdoor Resources Committee, at a later time, we will probably be discussing this topic again, and we will invite commissioners Holston and Meyer to be with us at that time.
What time was the meeting tomorrow morning? What time tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning, our committee starts at 8:30, but we have a time certain at 9:30 where we will invite Commissioner Holston in to start at 9:30.
And this was not our Representative Wagenius's or my intent to do it this way when we made the schedule out last week. But because targets were given and because deadlines were given, because I have to have my committee budget bill ready for posting by 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and we will vote on it on Wednesday morning at 8:30, we had to do it this way. So I think that you all can be understanding. This portion of the meeting is concluded, and Representative Wagenius's committee members may leave, unless you want to stay.
Well, we have a lot of fun. You guys want to stay?
No, you cannot. Not for a long time yet. Or a while yet. I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
I was just going to encourage people to fill out their topic selection.
Well, because this was a wonderful opportunity. You did that at caucus. It was perfect timing. Item on the agenda, which is really the third item on the agenda, Corey Kath, House File 2925, the Public Facilities Programs Amended and Technical Changes to the Policy Bill for the Public Facilities Authority, which is one of our main accounts. And we want to get this policy bill out of our hands before we pursue the budget. Welcome to the committee, Representative Kath, Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yes, House File 2925 is before you. I believe you'll need somebody to move it, and then there is an A1 amendment as well.
That's correct. I will move adoption of House File 2925 and be referred to Finance Committee. No?
I believe so.
Finance Committee? Yeah, because it came. And I will move adoption of HF 2925A1, an amendment that has been asked for by middle management employees, and it is a technical amendment that has been inserted in other bills that have to do with employees that are transferred. And it's my understanding that the author and Mr. Coleman both say it's just fine.
Yes, Madam Chair, we are completely amenable to the amendment.
Is there any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And does this mean that from now on, the employees of this entity will no longer be classified and never not have to work within the existing state personnel system in terms of comparable salaries and those sorts of things, given their responsibilities?
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, if I may answer. The combination of the language on page 1 and then section 16 at the end of the bill, plus the amendment that amends section 16 on page 11, doesn't do anything to change the status of the employees being state employees. what happened when we passed this bill 2 years ago and made the executive director responsible for the staff of the authority is without this clarifying language, I would have had to advertise, interview my employees over again, and their seniority would have started at the days of new hire. By going this route, they maintain their existing seniority, state class, everything. The only difference is they're no longer officially classified as DTED employees. They're officially classified as Public Facilities Authority employees, which was our intent 2 years ago.
Any other questions? If not all in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Kath, do you want to briefly explain the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Like Mr. Coleman said, and I'm going to let him address it as he is the expert on the Public Facilities Authority, and there's some technical changes here, some housekeeping that is necessary to move us forward, as well as to take a look at some new directions where we have some of the funding coming from. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, committee members, thanks for having us and hearing the bill. I'll go through it section by section relatively quickly, try to identify what the key points of those sections without getting into too much. But Section 1, as well as Section 15 in the back of the page, really clarifies the intent of what we tried to do 2 years ago, really defining my responsibility as executive director in a pretty much standard language as far as position descriptions, things like that. Our intent was to keep the staff and the seniority, and as far as no employee in classified service being suffering loss or anything like that is not my intent. All the people that work for the PFA have been handpicked by me over the years and are the greats to work with, so I plan on keeping them as long as they'll have me. Section 2, which starts on page two, top of page 2, is the Water Pollution Control Revolving Loan Fund, and we're making some changes there to comply with federal appropriation language for the funding this year. The EPA grant Congress and put language in there that not less than 30% of the funds after the first $1 billion have to be provided in additional subsidization, and they define that as principal forgiveness grants or negative interest. We've used the principal forgiveness as part of the ERA legislation last year. Appropriation bill continues the same method as the ERA, except ERA was not less than 50%. This language is will allow us to use the funds for principal forgiveness. What we tried to do here, though, is create, and we're modifying the WIF later on, is to make sure the federal funds and the state money that goes towards the wastewater infrastructure funding program can be used interchangeably. So the criteria will be the same, and the money will be treated the same, except for the federal strings on the dollars will be applied to those contracts that get the federal money. There's also a requirement in the federal legislation that not less than 25% of the funds must be used for green infrastructure. And that, I shouldn't say green infrastructure, but a variety of items that often fall into the category of green infrastructure: energy conservation, water retention, energy generation, as it applies to municipal wastewater treatment, and the same with drinking water as it applies to treating and delivery of drinking water. So it's not like we're going to go out and build power generation or generating plants and things like that, but as they are components of those facilities, try to make them a little more efficient and beneficial. In that program, we found in experiences that oftentimes it's a break-even point to add those type of facilities. It lowers operation maintenance costs, maybe have long-term benefits, but there's also some negatives. If there's another piece of equipment or another process that the operators have to be trained on and licensed in, so that we're proposing 25% of the green infrastructure projects be provided in principal forgiveness, try to promote those type of activities, incentive for cities to go ahead and do them. On page 3, section 3, we get into the wastewater infrastructure funding. No, take that back. Yeah, the wastewater infrastructure funding program. And there we made some minor changes on subdivision 1 to conform more to bonding requirements. Rather than use the term planning, we did pre-design, design. We also want to make it clear that the state funds can be used to purchase land and easement for those systems. That's pretty much it. In section 4, section 4 continues the wastewater infrastructure funding program. The changes occur on page 4, begin, and grammatical changes in section 4. Section 5, we're looking at converting, I mentioned this the last time I was in front of the committee, going from deferred loans from year 21 to 40 to kind of comply more with how rural development did theirs. EPA has allowed us now to go beyond 20-year loans, so we can do 30-year loans with the revolving loan fund, or the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund. So the idea of having a WIF as extending the loan terms doesn't seem real appropriate. And also to comply with the federal law, try to make the WIF program and the requirements for principal forgiveness this on the loan side of the equation that we're required to do. We're looking at making that a grant program the way it was, I think, 8 years ago and prior to that, since it was the program was created. What that does is mean we can do more projects. They get a little less money because there's less subsidy when you're providing grants versus deferred loans. For the overall, we will be able to do a little bit more. Cities will get a little less WIP, but it'll be in the form of a grant rather than deferred loan. We also, something we've looked at for the last couple years since PCA changed their rules, not only for ranking projects, but for type of projects they'll certify to us. They'll look at cost effectiveness first, and cities have to document that replacing septics, if that's something that can be done, they have to look at the cost. If septic replacement for on-sewered areas can't be, then they kind of go up the chain of command. So we don't have to build wastewater treatment systems just because cities want them if septics is a viable option, and then subsidize it with WIF program. So we don't see the need anymore using that method. We're also historically did WIF in the early years based on median household income to measure as a measure of affordability, but it was the lakeshore property owners coming in with $80-90 million wastewater treatment proposals to sewer multiple lakes and create a huge sanitary sewer district at cost of $70,000-$80,000 per household, which got us away from wanting to do that type of program. So we went to market value because that threw out most lakeshores, because a lot of the homes that wanted to get sewered happened to be upper six and seven and eight digit market value. So we went with market value as a percent, 5% of market value is affordability. And that kind of took lakeshore properties out of the WIP equation. We don't worry about that anymore. Those projects aren't being proposed. So we're looking at going back to median household income, better indicator of affordability. So that's the change on the type and amount of assistance. Our partnership with USDA, it really isn't changing. We're continuing to match their grants at a 65% level. Page 5, and section 7 through 10, we get into the small community wastewater treatment program. And there, we found a need to make several changes in that program. We have a lot of technical assistance grants out there. We have not required a work program, so there's those grants tend to be ongoing. We don't know when they're going to go from studying the problem to actually solving the problem. I should say studying solutions for the problem versus actually solving the problems. Some technical changes. We worked with PCA staff just trying to change the terminology a little bit from septic to subsurface wastewater treatment facilities and rather than individual wastewater treatment facilities, make it more current. I think the significant changes there on page 6 and get into the type of individuals we look at, providing assistance, provide independent advice on feasibility. We did have the solely worked with the University of Minnesota Ag Extension. I think I mentioned last time that two of the people that worked on that program retired. So there's kind of a gap there. So we're looking at other individuals that have the technical capacity to provide that advice. So nonprofit organizations, which would include Minnesota Rural Water, Midwest Assistance, and they can also contract for services to other providers. So go beyond just designers working, but that whole idea of technical assistance, part of the money goes for designers to do soil borings and look at sites, but also part of it is trying to get these communities to be able to operate and maintain those systems. And when you have to deal with some of these real small units of government, that's a big leap because they've never really had anything that they've had responsibility to operate and maintain before. So things like user fees and maintenance schedules for pumping out septic systems or mound systems. On page 8 and 10, we get into the drinking water revolving loan fund, and as we're doing with the wastewater, we're trying to create our statutes to allow us to give principal forgiveness. Because that's a requirement under the appropriations for drinking water, except under that program, they just say not less than 30% of the funds have to be used for principal forgiveness. We have always had the ability to make grants with the state revolving loan fund up to 10% of the amount appropriated in the past. So we used a figure of 1.4% median household income and required an urgent health threat, such as arsenic or chemicals. In the water, bacteria, anything that would require cities to do immediate action, we would provide grants once the cost hit 1.4% of median household income. And looking at the conditions of the water systems in Minnesota, we don't have a lot of systems that are at that stage where they have those known natural contaminants in their system that are regulated. So we're looking at dropping that formula down from 1.4 to 1.2, hope to get more communities eligible so we can spend that 30%. And we're also eliminating that urgent health threat or that contaminant level to qualify. So it'll be strictly based on affordability. We do worry about getting rid of that federal money, even though it's free. So drinking water systems are a lot different than wastewater. They're a lot cheaper. Minnesota's been blessed with abundance of water, although the quality varies throughout the state and from area to area. We're a lot better off than a lot of states are when it comes to drinking water. But that doesn't mean I don't want to return the money to Washington and give to other states. So that's the object for that. And then on the page 11, really the last article, the Public Facilities Authority operates a credit enhancement program for counties and cities. Counties, we will certify their general obligation bonds if it's related to social service or criminal justice-related buildings. We'll certify that, and our certification means that the state will actually pay the debt service if there's a default, if there's any money in the general fund. It's an open appropriation of the general fund dollars, so if there's any money available, we'll pay the bondholders to make sure they're paid. And then work out arrangements to repay the state at the interest rate the state would earn on those monies if they had kept them. and also have state aid intercept component, things like that. With the municipalities, we limit that guarantee to water and sewer projects, storm sewer, so pretty much related to our drinking water program and drinking water program for projects that don't go through our programs but do the same type. They can use that certification. It does give cities Moody rates the certification of the AA, and S&P and Fitch both rated as AAA. So it's as good as the state's GO bond rating on two rating agencies and a notch below on Moody's. Moody's rates the state AA1, and this is just, and Moody's gives these projects AA. What it means is save cities about a 0.5% interest on BBB cities or cities that don't get ratings. Counties, most counties are A-rated now. Obviously, in some are AAA, so the scale there. There are a few BBBs. It just does. It offers them just a little better access to the market at cheaper interest rates. And it has varied over the years. Right now, I'd say that gap between the AAA and a BBB is probably about 0.5%. So, over 20 years, a lot of money in interest. That's the bill, Madam Chair, real quick.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question here. The percentage breakdown between bonds and loans that you do know, or excuse me, grants and loans, what percent do you do of each, roughly?
Historically, the average PFA is about 90% loan and 10% grant when you look at the total dollars that have gone through us. The Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or WIF, has been our primary source of grant money in the past, and that has amounted to probably closer to 5% of our total output as far as cash. In recent years, that amount of money has increased. Also, we have this committee has provided us funds for clean water, small community system, phosphorus reduction grants, and TMDL grants, so that proportion of grant funding is creeping up to around 10% of what we do.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Coleman, and do you expect that percent is going to keep on, you'll keep transitioning toward more grants than before?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, that all depends on the amount of appropriations provided by the legislature for grants. I think with the federal government finally getting back into the grant business after a 20-year, or more than, well, yeah, 20 years of getting out of the business, you might see that proportion going up some.
Okay,
we are doing more numbers of grant-needed projects because we've had the resources in recent years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Coleman, one final question again. I know that water rates aren't supposed to exceed a certain limit. And is that set by a percent, or is there a monetary amount?
Madam Chair, Representative
Coleman.
Currently, on the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, we only do 80% of the costs that exceed 5% of market value. We're proposing 1.4%. Of median household income, and I think on our list there's only two cities that would not qualify for WIF or currently qualify for WIF based on that change. Higher incomes but low market value. Otherwise, most of the communities would still get it. The subsidy is a little different mechanism, so they might get a little less WIF dollars, so that subsidy has a more impact on the sewer rates. So a little less sewer rates. We'd like to see, in the ideal world, we'd like to see sewer rates before we subsidize them in the $40 to $45 range. And we don't like them getting into the $65 and on up. We do have a lot of communities that are in the $100 range, to be honest.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Just to clarify then, so that the water rates then are set by a percent of income.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Coleman.
To a degree, we only fund 80% of the cost once they exceed that cost. So if they're proposing a lot of or a high-cost system, the rates are going to be up higher. So it's a combination of income and type of system or type of solution to the problems they have that the city wants to build. Generally, some of the real high-cost projects on a per capita basis are because they built in a lot for growth. We don't subsidize growth. We only subsidize the current users and the current users' needs. So if they're building capacity to double the size of the current use, I mean, we're only paying for half. We only look at half the cost, and they're picking up 100% of the loan and the rest of it.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just sat through a presentation by the legislative auditor, and the auditor was holding DNR's feet to the fire because DNR has not done a long-term budget analysis comparing what we're doing to the long-term needs. Do you have a budget analysis that we can read or a spreadsheet? We have it for Parks and Trails that shows where we're going and how we're going to get there.
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, no, we don't. We tend to work off MPCA's needs list. That has grown substantially in the last year with ERA funding to the point. We felt comfortable if we could finance $300 million a year, just looking at the needs and the growth of needs every year that come in the door. If we could hit that $300 million mark a year, seeing those improvements done, we could keep up with the demand. So that's kind of our budget plan, where we know what's needed on the list that's visible, and cities are willing to come to the plate. But there's a lot of other needs out there.
That is the point. There are a lot of needs that aren't on the list. It seems to me that in order for us to understand where, if the $300 million is an appropriate number, should it be something else, we have to have that long-term plan analysis written out for us. And so I don't know whether that's your job or PCA's job, but it does seem to be something that we should be having.
Mr. Coleman.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wadenius, I would love to have that information to be able to do the plan, and I'd be more than willing if I really knew how to do it. There's a lot of variables there, too, and how much the state will pay and subsidize cities either through low-interest loans or grants to upgrade versus how much cities are willing to tap investors and developers when their growth occurring. And right now, I think one of the reasons there's a huge growth in needs is cities aren't seeing the growth and developers aren't picking up the tab for infrastructure improvements that cities expect to make.
Representative Guinness.
I know that you have to make some assumptions when you're doing a long-term analysis, but if the assumptions are written down and we agree to the assumptions, we as a community agree to the assumptions, we can have an honest discussion about where we're going. But without that, we're working in the dark. And it does seem that, I mean, you don't want to have the legislative auditor telling you that, so let's just see if we can't get something done like that.
Well, I'm looking at Lisa Starvig from PC. we need help. They do study and survey cities. Is it every year or every other year? Trying to look at that, you know, 5-year and longer picture, but that's still based on what cities are willing to submit. So. And that number is a lot bigger than on the needs list, probably by double, triple. So we know there's a lot of needs out there that are beyond the stuff we see that come in our door.
Double, triple? We need to know that.
Yeah.
Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Coleman, there's a piece in here about employee transfer from deed to your department. Could you flesh that out a little bit as far as numbers of employees involved and just why this is occurring?
Sure. Madam Chair, currently I am the only employee of the Public Facilities Authority. The intent 2 years ago with kind of permissive language was to have those employees that have worked for the authority for years to be authority employees. life isn't that simple. And the Attorney General's office was fine with the language 2 years ago, but I guess a lot of others weren't, because the issues, I would have had to literally advertise, interview, go through the standard employee hiring that state agencies would go through, and this current staff would lose their seniority. I only intend to transfer those employees that currently are paid by the PFA that are currently assigned to D. So there's 8 FTEs there. There's actually eight people that work for the PFA besides myself, and there's one individual who's not specifically listed as in Deed's roster as PFA employee that spends about 85% of his time working on our stuff, and he would stay with Deed for now. So it's, and I'll explain the reason, the rationale for the transfer, because that is a real key here. The PFA is a statutory appropriated entity. We were created to make contractual obligations that the state normally doesn't let state agencies do. In order to get federal funding, we had to assure EPA and the federal government that we would operate in perpetuity, not subject to biannual appropriations. To keep bondholders and our bonds secure, which they are, they have been AAA long before the state got their AAA ratings on their bonds, and we hold AAAs from all three rating agencies because we've assured bondholders that we will have the staff and resources to operate and maintain the funds, collect payments from municipalities, and make bondholder payments. Twice in the past decade, we've had budget situations where Deed's budget has not passed or come real close to the deadline where the Public Facilities Authority assigned staff. It was questionable whether or not they could transfer the employees. I mean, we've done things like the board, that is, move the responsibilities over to state agencies whose budget has passed. I think the last one we transferred the PFA over to MMB by resolution until Deed's budget was set. Fortunately, it got passed, I think, the day before, June 30th, so we didn't have to do that. But it is problematic when you have an agency like that, having a staff with an agency like us that really can't do that. By the way, the Attorney General's office told the Commissioner of Deed at the time, if he did lay off the PFA staff with the budget resolution, they would not represent him in a lawsuit because that would be considered gross negligence. So,
Representative Torkelson.
This clarifies the issue.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, moving forward, will you be doing your own hiring?
Within the budget constraints set by the authority, yes. And just as any commissioner would hire staff.
Just one more question, Madam Chair and Director Coleman. Does this significantly change the structure of PFA and its relationship to the other state agencies?
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr.
Torkelson,
Coleman.
Not at all. Not at all.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Coleman. And this is not showing any distrust of your work. It's just kind of approaching it from kind of the good government mm-hmm. perspective. And then I have just a very basic question that's a definition I don't see anywhere here. But it looks to me like an open and standing appropriation, there's almost none of those left. I mean, that is really takes the appropriation powers out of the legislature. And this makes sweeping changes when you were only a loan, when some of these programs were only loans, and you had to set up the payments to match the revenue stream. But now you're mixing grants and loans, and you're changing the criteria by which you'll assess them, and then adding new purposes such as environmentally in innovative activities up to $1 million. I could name a whole lot of people who could come up with some creative uses for that language. And it just feels to me like you're going from a small, conservative, kind of controlled set of financial tools to kind of the Wild West with a lot of different pieces and lots of different tools that you can use. You can even hire and fire your own staff and do that. And I think of things like the reports that came out when the Charitable Gambling Board had that same sort of authority and there wasn't enough checks and balances. We all looked bad. And, the report that we just heard said, for the best of intentions, we sometimes give lots of authority and then we kind of afterwards go, wow, we didn't think about this or that or the other thing. And so I personally think that this is even in terms of, if you look on page 10, lines 10.3 to 10.9, you're authorized to reduce the percentage of median household income at which a loan term could go to 30 years if in any way you think you might leave some federal money from being used, but it doesn't set any criteria. So if you had four communities that, all wanted a project, and in order to use the federal money, you had to, change the terms. It doesn't give you any criteria by which you're going to decide which of those four gets the most financially advantaged situation. And I'm just kind of uncomfortable with giving this broad an authority without any checks or balances within the legislation itself. And I almost feel like this is something that should go to the Government Operations Committee. And I know that's a horrible thing to say to anyone on deadline week. But it does feel like it's a really major change in the flexibilities. And because you have an open and standing appropriation, we're at risk anytime things get kind of out of kilter. So if you could just kind of give me some assurance, yes. And then I'll ask my definition
Madam
question.
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr. Coleman.
I would gladly respond to it. most of the changes to the programs we're proposing outside of the WIF, where we're looking at changing from property values to median household income formula, which the program used to be, because it just makes sense to do that. The changes in the two loan programs are required because the federal government requires that. That is, in their appropriation language, they like the era so much that they, for the first time in 20 years, federal law prohibited us from making grants or anything like that out of the revolving loan funds until last year when era passed. And then they appropriated money to the Clean Water and Drinking Water Loan and said half the money must be used for grants, principal forgiveness, or negative interest. And the states need to look at how to provide that assistance to disadvantaged communities, which the term was left up for the states to define. We've just defined it in our rules as a disadvantaged community when the cost hits the median household income of in the drinking water program, 1.4% of median household income. That's a disadvantage to have that high of a cost for that type of service. So it's as uncomfortable as I am personally about using what should be equity dollars that we can build the capacity to make loans for cities. Now we have to use 30% of that federal appropriation for, in essence, grants, so we don't get a return on that money again. It's just a requirement of the funds. And I think it's going to stay with the appropriations at the federal level because cities across the country have been asking for grant funds to help subsidize projects. Minnesota's been a little unique in the sense that we're one of the very few states that have a grant program for wastewater projects. There are a handful and I know several states that have copied us the WIF program because it makes a lot of sense. So we're not creating a lot of new authority. We're just complying with federal law. Open appropriations, the only open appropriation is the credit enhancement program.
That's a question.
I mentioned that the PFA is a statutory authority, appropriate entity. That doesn't mean legislature can't restrict and control our funds at any time. That's your prerogative. Barring any appropriation bill, likewise, the revenues we collect, and we do collect fees on all of our loans, and EPA has been allowing us to use the fees we collect on loan repayments to cover the state-funded programs. for the most part. We also have the capacity under state law to charge a 0.5% of the grants we make. We haven't done that yet, but that's something we'll be looking at in the future, cover the cost of implementing and managing the clean water legacy programs. So I don't see us. I can tell you my staff feel overwhelmed at times because it's not only we make loans and grants. We've always done that since the WIC program was created and calculated, but the federal requirements that have increased drastically. We get into doing the what is considered green or energy efficient stuff. I mean, PCA, we've set it up through rules now where PCA certifies those based on as-bid cost of that component of the treatment plant. So it's not something the authorities saying this is eligible for this. I mean, it's PCA engineers actually reviewing as-bid costs and how much of those costs are eligible and how much is eligible for grants versus loans. So it's we look at ourselves as kind of the banker. We get the money out the door. PCA on the wastewater tells us what's fundable and what's eligible, like what's TMDL versus phosphorus versus SRF loan versus WIP. They do provide all those input because there are limitations. Department of Health does the same thing on the drinking water side. They literally look at as-bid costs and break down those components and tell us what is eligible and for how much. I hope that answers your question.
But. Well, Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler
and Mr. Coleman, I have been convinced that this has been a very responsibly run organization to date, at least everything I've heard. At the same time, when you tell me, well, we're just the banker, and bankers aren't really in high repute right now. They've made some mistakes. And part of my concern is you're mostly dealing with very small communities, and you're basing it on current needs rather than projected development, which I think is a good basis to deal with it. If they want to do a new development, they have to figure out how to get the developers to pay for it. But at the same time, I'm still struck by, and I can't remember off the top of my head the year, but it was fairly recently, I looked at birth data, and 70% of, I think it was 71%, or 69, right around there, of the births in Minnesota were in the 7-county metro area. And so some of these communities that we're going to be investing in, I just wonder about their ability to sustain these loan payments based on projected usage and things long term. And so, I mean, I do think there is some risk just because of changing demographics in the kind of communities that you're working with. So I do think that we should try over time to try and really do what Representative Wagenius has suggested, which is really look at long-term needs, but also create some stronger criteria about how we're going to evaluate these projects as they go forward. The question I have, and I can't find a definition here, but maybe it's somewhere else in statute, is there's lots of references to green infrastructure. And St. Patrick's Day is coming, and I know green is going to be all over St. Paul, but I've seen green in all over the legislation this year. And it seems like every piece of legislation has a different shade or definition of green. And in your work, what is green infrastructure?
Okay. Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, EPA has a website that states have to comply with, a laundry list of all types of different things. PCA, I think, has summarized that and put it on their website. Department of Health is likewise. But I use the term green rather loosely, not like a lot of other people use it. As part of a wastewater treatment plant or pumping sewage to a wastewater treatment plant, there's a lot of energy cost. If people didn't know this, the largest electrical user in the Twin Cities metropolitan area is Met Council at their wastewater treatment plants. So that a lot of energy gets used in that process, not only wastewater treatment, but also drinking water. There's, the energy efficiency of pumps is one thing. So anything to reduce energy costs. There's also techniques you can do. The wastewater stream is full of energy, to be honest, can be converted to do lots of things from cooking sludge to generate electricity, generating steam. You can do a lot of things with it. Those type of activities, and a lot of cities won't do it because it's additional equipment, and it, you know, if they look at the capital cost versus the operating cost, it saves them some money to do that, but they won't do it simply because it's only a break even, and they'll stick with things. So we're, from an energy conservation and water conservation technique, we're trying to provide that financial incentive so cities are willing to help us comply with that federal mandate that 25% of the federal funds that we get go towards these type of projects. But it's really meant, if you look at it from an energy standpoint, if you can reduce the energy or generate energy in the process, that's eligible. If you can reduce the use of water or retain water tension, that is like storm water, if you can keep it in the area and let it settle, recharge the aquifers versus flushing it down the river as fast as it can go and take all the sediment with it, that is things that EPA has kind of classified as green versus a lot of other things that might get passed for.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just ask you to look back through the bill, and every place I can see green infrastructure, it's followed by water or energy efficiency improvements. Yes. And so what you've just described would fit that definition of water or energy efficiency improvements. So the question is there anything else? Otherwise, I'd just drop it because we have so many definitions of green that if it doesn't really add anything that you couldn't otherwise do, I just stay with the water and energy efficiencies.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is either for the author or Mr. Kuhlman. I missed the setup of the bill, and so maybe this was covered. But I just wanted to, on page 11, it talks about the amount of debt obligation authorized, and that is doubled from $500 million to $1 billion of authorized debt allowance. And I'm just curious, that's a pretty sweeping jump. What necessitates that, or what's behind the jump in debt authorization?
Okay. Madam Chair, this is the credit enhancement program. It used to be the county credit enhancement program, which was created to allow the state to back the bonds of local counties that are selling bonds for criminal justice and social service buildings. And that, like I mentioned, it gives Fitch and Standard & Poor's rates bonds that have this credit enhancement as AAA, and Moody's rates it as AA, one notch below their rating of the state GO bonds. So it provides an interest setting on a general obligation debt of counties historically. About 4 years ago, it was changed to include municipalities when they issue debt outside the PFA debt for water and sewer and stormwater improvements. So we had that $500 million capacity pretty much got eaten up in the last few years with water and sewer funding. About a fourth of the issues we've certified in the last 3-4 years were for refunding old debt. This is a contingent liability that the rating agencies look at, and the state has a lot of them. I don't know if anybody listened to Kathy Cardell's presentation on Capital Investment Committee in the past, but this program is very much like the school loan program that has $13 billion worth of debt outstanding, and there's no cap on that. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, I believe they do have a cap of $5 or $6 billion. Those are moral obligation bonds, which is a separate contingent liability. We've worked with MMB and Kathy. I understand, because I've worked with rating agencies a lot and how they look at the states. I don't want this program to have any negative impact on the state's general obligation credit ratings or bond ratings, so we limited it. We also, if the state is going to provide that subsidy on these loans, we kind of wanted to see construction work actually occur, so we eliminated the refunding. So if they've done the project, we don't want to subsidize the debt. But if the state can gain a little sales tax and income tax off employees and materials, will do it. Plus, it saves cities around about a half percent interest on their outstanding debt. So it's a sizable amount of interest savings in the long term. And Minnesota has never had a GO default yet by a local unit of government. So we're crossing our fingers. And it's not, and the GO general obligation or the certification is contingent on money being in the general fund. So there might not be any money in the general fund today. But the state was in a much stronger position when this program was created. So it's not a guarantee, but it's an enhancement.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Coleman, do you have any figure on the total local taxpayer savings because of these long-term, low-interest loans that you are able to offer?
Is that in our summary sheet? So far we've done 55 bond issues. If you look at that on the last, $356 million in the last 55 bond issues, and that's an interest savings of $6.3 million for counties. For cities, we've done $129 million, and the savings there, about $5.7 million. And the difference between the two is counties are much higher rated than the state, so their interest savings is less, where a lot of the cities that use these are unrated or triple B rated credits, so the gap between this credit versus their credit is more substantial. But it's, yeah, all total combined, talking about $12 million.
In property tax savings.
Yeah.
Any other questions? If not, I renew my motion that House File 2925 as amended be recommended to pass and go to the Finance Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Good luck, Representative Kath.
Thank you. As you can see, it was a simple bill, Madam Chair.
Yes, just a simple 15-minute bill. Great. But now you know the questions that you have to be prepared for. Thank you. Representative Hansen, House File 3015. Film production costs reimbursement provided.
Madam Chair, I think I'll say that this is a complex and difficult bill. It may take a long period of time. I have with me... This is a bill that was brought to me by the film board, and I have a couple of testifiers to explain the bill, and there is an amendment as well, and I'd like if someone could move the bill, and then we could move the DA1 amendment to get the bill in the shape. I don't believe I can make a motion as an ex officio.
Representative Hausman.
Move it.
Representative Hausman moves adoption of House File 3015. Representative Hausman moves to amend House File 3015 with the delete everything amendment. And that's the way the author wants it, right?
Correct.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the amendment. And that the amendment will bring the... has brought the bill into, I think, a way to help with providing reimbursements for film production. I know we're going to be dealing with budget cuts and issues in this committee, but what the bill does, it changes statute, and so that hopefully we'll have better times ahead and the program that's worked well can work in the future. And I would turn it over to my two testifiers.
Mr. Edmund, Ms. Winter.
Madam Chair, my name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism, and I'm just going to very briefly speak to the original bill that we asked to be brought before you today. House File 3015 basically is dealing with trying to catch the such in law with the statute. The Film Jobs Production Program was funded in 2006 legislative session. At that time, session law was changed to provide a reimbursement of up to 15% of the film production costs. This language, however, was not included in the statutes for the Film Board. So in 2007, Film and TV Board amended the statutory language to provide the ability to make reimbursements of up to 20% of film production costs for film that incur project costs in excess of $5 million. The intent was to have this option into the additional language. Because the original reimbursement language was not in statute, having a portion of the language in statute causes us, as Explore Minnesota Tourism, which has the responsibility for administering these dollars, difficulty when writing grants and citing the authorizing language. But basically, the original intent of the legislation was just to address this problem, to have the original language that was included in session law added to the statute. And so we're perfectly fine with that. We just think it's a real simple cleanup of what was in session law and getting into the statutes. So I just want to speak to the purpose that we had asked that this bill be brought up before you. And then I think Lucinda Winter will then talk to the amendments and the change.
Ms. Winter.
My name is Lucinda Winter. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Film and Television Board. Good evening, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members. I'm here to speak very briefly in support of the amendment. And the intent of this amendment, and I don't know if you have the amendment language. I can certainly read it to you.
We have it.
I'm trying to encourage more production into greater Minnesota. The reason the leave behind or the handout that you have is a cost analysis based on a recent production that did an extensive scout in New Ulm, in the Duluth and Iron Range area, and in the Twin Cities. And based on their cost analysis that you can see there, and this was about a $4.2 million production. It will vary for higher cost productions and longer shoot dates. But it's a good analysis. It's very contemporary. This production is being shot right now in the Twin Cities. The reason they did not locate in New Ulm or in Duluth, even though both cities did excellent jobs of hosting the scout and showing what the cities could do, there was no question the cities could not do the job for this production company, was based on cost. I think, I gave out all mine, but it was roughly $350,000 more to shoot in greater Minnesota. Those costs are based on, and to some degree, it's based on your hotel room nights. You'll see there, scenario A is if you have a 30 buck a night hotel, and this is for long-term stays, or D, if you're able to get your crew and cast into slightly more expensive hotels. Your costs are still going to be higher anytime you go outside the metropolitan area. My effort with this amendment is to encourage more production into greater Minnesota by taking a little bit of the sting out of those increased costs. And I think this is one way that I can encourage the production into the smaller communities in our state that benefit greatly from the economic activity that always occurs when you have production. There's increased tourism, there's a higher profile for those communities. And with this simple change, it has nothing to do with the amount of appropriation, just how we're using the appropriation. And that's, we have done this in consultation with our Snow Bay Operations Committee, which is comprised of professionals in the industry, and our legislative task force, also volunteers from the industry. And there was virtually no objection among those people, many of whom are from the metro area, to this change.
So this is a technical and housekeeping change and a recommendation from the Snowbait people for the amendment.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And as John Edmund said, even if the worst case occurs and we do lose our Snowbait funding and we even were to have to close the Film Commission, once this exists in statute, then it's on the books, and if the program is ever lit up again, then we're ready to go. So it can't. There's absolutely no harm that could come from making this change now.
Any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Lucinda. I'm just still learning this stuff, and I really hope that we can get Snowbait going again. But it seems to me that when you have a major production like the one that's being filmed right now, They also bring in the director and the star power and all those kinds of people and some specialized crew members that the people hired locally, whether in Greater Minnesota or in the Twin Cities, tend to have the lower paying sort of supportive roles. Mm-hmm. So I don't see in your cost analysis the differences in that, because clearly it's for their star power. The Twin Cities, you know, is disadvantaged in that it's much more expensive to put your stars in a luxury suite in any one of the whole seven county metros, hotels, and their lead, you know, people who bring in the trucks with all the equipment and their lead film editors and those sorts of things. And so does that tend to, I'm just trying to understand what the balance is between these crew members having to go to Greater Minnesota, some of whom might be there. I mean, we've got a great arts program in UMD and some other places now that are providing talent for this kind of stuff in Greater Minnesota. So I'm wondering if that's an offset. I personally tend to not like to have too many distinctions between regions of the state. I think that tends to divide us unless it's really true. And so I just want to know, if you factored that in, would they be more equal?
Ms. Winter.
Madam Chair and Representative, the fact of the matter is that the majority of the crew, there's crew all over Minnesota, but the vast majority of our crew base is living in the metropolitan area. That's where most of the work is. So since 2005 when I took this job, we've tried time and time again to push production into Greater Minnesota with a lot of assistance from municipalities. And there always seems to be the same problem. That even, and if you look at the bottom of this sheet, outstate savings vary. There are some savings that accrue to being in a smaller community, but they just don't match up with the costs of, for example, if you're going to, we can take North Country as an example. When you take stars and all the people who are working above the line and below the line on a production and you move them to the Iron Range, you have to pay them travel days. You can't work and travel on the same day if you're an actor. It's just in your contract. You have to pay per diems for them to be outside. If they're not going home at night, you're paying them a per diem. It varies depending on the budget of the film and the deal that is made with crew and with talent. But there are so many costs that are, the shipping costs are higher, gas is higher, everything is a little bit higher. So this is really an attempt. While it's true that hotel costs might be higher in the Twin Cities, fewer people are staying in hotels. For example, on the Convincer, they have 95 people working on the movie. The great majority of them are Minnesotans. There may be 20 people on the movie who are not from Minnesota. Those people are all going home at night, and the ones who are staying in hotels have gotten very advantageous deals because they're renting hotels for sometimes up to 3 months. So the day rate is not what you or I would pay were we to go and check in somewhere downtown. It's and given the economic climate right now and the fact that it's the dead of winter, they've been able to get really good metro area hotel deals, even in some of our higher end hotels. So I mean, it wasn't without careful thought that we proposed this, but I really believe that it's my job to work for the whole state, and I really think that this is going to work for the state.
Madam Chair, I think this is good for the whole state as well. I just like when we have a distinction that we've really made sure that we've looked at all the factors, and I just didn't see that for the talent that's flown in from wherever.
Right. Yeah, it's just, I think this is going to help us defray some of those costs. I really do. So,
any further questions? Representative Matt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious if you could shed some light on what other states, maybe in the region, would be helpful, what kind of incentives they have, and then if there's data or information as far as what it's brought into the state to give us an idea of if these incentive programs have worked in other states as far as bringing in the money and the things that they're aiming to do. Has it proven to be that, or has it been a wash, or is there any data on that you have?
There is, Madam Chair and Representative, there is data, and you know, I can't rattle off it. I can tell you the states that lead in production incentives Among them is New Mexico, Louisiana, New York, now Georgia. Chicago has a 30% tax credit. These states, some of whom have been in the incentive business for up to about 10 years now, if you look at the New Mexico and Louisiana models, they have created industries there that are in excess of $1 billion. So there, New Mexico has a 25% tax credit. Louisiana has a 25% tax credit. They all, every program is different. Some of them will pay, for example, Michigan pays 42%. But only 30% on non-resident crew, which is still extremely generous. And I don't know if any of you have seen, there was a CBS News story recently, which I think I sent to Nancy, the link, in case anybody wanted to see it, to Nancy Conley. But they are hoping that with this credit that they have, it's a rebate, that they are going to be able in some small way to make up for some of the losses they've experienced in jobs with the auto industry. They are retraining guys who worked on the line to work in grip, gaff, electrical positions on set and then move up from there. And they are providing a training program to do so that's subsidized by the state. And they're also opening a sound stage now. So it depends on how I think the program fits into the larger economic development plan that a state has. But there are very few states that have gotten into the incentive business that haven't seen enough of a return that they've gotten out. And I think numbers, as you know, we know, numbers lie and liars figure, whatever the saying is. I mean, I want it, in order to quote any kind of numbers, I would want to be very sure about them. And many states have had Ernst & Young and others do analyses to see what kind of direct and indirect economic impact there has been. And some of the studies are clearly flawed, but all of them show a return. It's a question of how, if you want to believe the degree of some of their returns. The figure we use for our indirect is 1.99, and that comes directly from DEED. So in the last 2 years, with the appropriation we've had, which is a modest appropriation for Snowbait, we've brought in $15 million additional dollars in direct. And if you use that multiplier, that's closer to $30 million in direct and indirect. So it can be significant. I had an analyst from DEED do an analysis of North Country after shot on the range, and so he had he looked completely at their Bible, which is actually their huge three ring of all their costs and all their payments, and his Bob's analysis revealed a $5 million. Direct economic impact in on the range, which in a smaller community of group of communities can be really, really significant. So,
okay. All right. Any other questions? If not, I renew my motion that House File 3015, as amended with DE1, be held over to become the omnibus supplemental finance bill. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Nornes. This is an information bill. We don't have it in our possession at this time.
All right. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3143. If you have it in front of you, it's a quick one. I think it's on line 1.14, we scratch 4, the word 4. And to reason, tell you why, I've got John Edmond here, Director of Explore Minnesota, to explain.
Just one word. Mr. Edmond.
Madam Chair, members, I'll try to be relatively brief in giving you an explanation of this one-word change in the statutes. Explore Minnesota Tourism Council was created in 2004 to provide advice and direction to us, Explore Minnesota Tourism. The council is appointed by the governor and consists of 28 members consisting of various representatives of the Minnesota tourism industry. At the time the council was created, we had four tourism regions in the state. Following a long year of review process with the tourism industry, we reorganized and now have five tourism regions. So the language of 3143 removes the reference to the number of regions, but just leaves the category, thus eliminating any need to amend the language for any reason such as this in the future. And the bill maintains the reference to 28 voting members.
And what's happening with it in GovUp? Or wherever it is? Local government. State and local government.
I don't have an answer for that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, I believe the bill is on the agenda tomorrow morning in Representative Kowalski's committee.
You're right.
Okay. Yeah. So, and it's likely to pass. And it doesn't, since it's just that change in a board or change in your regions, I don't think we have to have it come to us. Right. Does anyone want to make a request for it to come to this committee since we know what it's about now? Hearing none. Go on your way. Have five tourist regions or as many as is needed, Mr. Edmund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for being so patient with us, Representative Norris. Last week and the week before, we had testimony on the supplemental budget finance bill, or the recommendations by the governor, and we had responses to the governor on his supplemental finance recommendations, but we did not hear from some of the people that are in our jurisdiction. The reason we did not hear from them was that they were not asked to make cuts by the governor's office or the budget office and budget management. And in looking at the spreadsheets, I said that we probably should not ignore these agencies that are under our responsibility. And so we sent out invitation to each of the agencies to come before us and tell us what they would do if they had been asked to submit recommendations for cuts or why they couldn't, why they shouldn't be cut. And so some of these agencies have asked to come or have accepted our invitation and are here tonight. Minnesota International Center? Nope. Maybe they're busy with their Pakistani guests that visited us this afternoon. The Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center, Farm America. Welcome to the committee, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Hegarty, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors of Farm America. I just found out this noon that the Executive Director, James Gibson, was not available, would not be able to come up, and called and asked me if I would come up. And for those of you that are on the Ag Committee, normally you see me as a veterinarian discussing animal health problems. That's not what I'm going to talk about today. I'm simply going to say that we were not prepared to make cuts. We have received $128,000 a year for at least the last 4 years. It's not gone up, but we're very thankful we've not been asked to make cuts during that time. We operate on a very tight budget. We have three part-time employees that cost us about $107,000. Our budget is roughly the $128,000 from the legislature, another $16,000 in grants from counties, and the remainder of it comes from, I can tell you in a moment, from admissions, because we do charge admissions to various events. We do charge rent. We do have some other programs, but roughly the $144,000 that we receive from the state and the counties is about half of what we receive, and our expenditures are almost equal to that.
Any questions? Thank you. Oh, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just pointing at Representative Morgan, but I will just... I was wondering if he went there 2 years ago with Representative Yaros, although I don't think he made it. We did go down and tour Farm America a couple years ago, and it is a, you know, certainly a worthwhile educational venue, and you know, I applaud you for the work that you've done there. And Representative Morgan, were you there, too, that day? All right.
I went with Representative Dorman. Got a big rock from there. Real pretty pink one. It's in my garden. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Valerie Doslin, the Minnesota Children's Museum. And the Duluth Children's Museum could not come down, so you'll be representing children's museums.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm Denise Fossey. I am the Chief Development Officer for the Minnesota Children's Museum.
Thank you for coming, Ms. Fossey.
Thank you for having us. I do have some information about the museum that I'd like to pass out. And we were not recommended for cuts in the governor's budget. We currently receive about $520,000 over each biennium for the Children's Museum. Each year we receive a little over 400,000 visitors to the museum. Approximately 120,000 of those visitors come through what we call our Access Program, which is a program that is free or greatly reduced admissions. We also welcome about 73,000 children and their teachers throughout the state. Every child in second, third, and fourth grade in St. Paul comes to the museum at a greatly reduced rate. We train teachers, we train care providers. We do a lot of outreach to parents, offering parent support, and in that regard, we strengthen families. The funding that we receive from the state of Minnesota represents approximately 6% of our budget. After last year, 40% of our income is contributed. We did see a dip in those contributions. We took laid off approximately 10% of our staff. If we were to receive a cut, that would have a significant impact on our ability to operate, in our ability to maintain the access that we have. So I fully support the recommendation that we not lose our funding. We are visible and do outreach in 85 of 87 counties throughout the state through our Discover Learning Trunks or through direct interactions or visits. We are currently looking at exploring some regional models so that we can do more in early childhood education. And our mission is, of course, sparking children's learning through play, which we took from some very visionary educators in the late 70s and early 80s. And now that is really being accepted as the way that children learn, and we see ourselves as having much enrichment and, in a sense, prevention of future problems for children in our state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Fossey. We would never, ever think of stripping you.
Thank you.
Maybe a nick or two. What? Tell me about your admissions.
Our access admissions are 120,000 children and families and caregivers each year. And that is supported in large part by the revenue that we get from the state appropriation. We also get some support from corporations and from private individuals to support that level of access to the museum. We like to think of ourselves as being a great example, Madam Chair, of public and private and nonprofit working together in ways that benefit our community.
And your admission is what you get from the state is $260,000 a year.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Any questions? Thank you very much for refreshing us on your mission.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Science Museum of Minnesota. We remember the presentation from last year, but we need a little refreshing. And
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Joining me today is Brenda Rainey, our Director for Government Relations and External Affairs. I am delighted that you have this time to meet with us when asked to testify before the Senate. One senator asked, is it that the governor overlooked you? And I said, no, my mission in the Science Museum is that no one will overlook it. I simply know that it was one of the most lucid moments in budgetary decision-making this year by our government. We are delighted that the governor and the Senate saw clear to maintain their support for the Science Museum of Minnesota. We believe now more than ever it's an essential support to the infrastructure of this state and setting right the difficulties that we face from this economy. We understand how difficult that is to face this budget in these times. And we hope that the Science Museum will be seen as a part of the solution for this state, laying a foundation for continuing growth and well-being. We believe that science is an essential literacy and that science literacy helps us engage our community in civic discourse and helps assure that our young people have a future that will serve our state and our nation and our world. We hope to tell you a story in the next just 2 minutes or so about what we're doing with your share of the appropriation. The state appropriation is roughly 3% of the Science Museum's budget, but it is among the most critical 3% that we have. We find donors who are very willing to support great experiences such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, but I've yet to find a donor who will put on the side of our window washing provided by, or in our carpeting, cleaning provided by. What the state appropriation does is it provides us with the foundation which serves in our interest in leveraging our resources for the greater good of Minnesota. We've had some great success in the last year. Because we have that foundation, we were able to convince 3M, General Mills, and others to help us invest in our teacher professional development and training programs. And today we provide more teacher professional development and training in science, technology, engineering, and math than any other agency in the state of Minnesota. Because we had the state resources to allow us to leverage opportunities, we took our time out of our staff to write a grant to Cargill for $2.45 million to provide programming, the first in the nation, all district implementation of an engineering curriculum for Hopkins and Minneapolis school districts. We're writing grants for them with the foundations that you gave us. We've been able to track that the two most improved elementary science MCA scores were directly attributed them to their programming with our science house in the Science Museum of Minnesota. We've been able to attract visitors to help us support programming such as our Great Tickets program. Through our Great Tickets program, someone who is in high need can, for as little as a dollar, get a ticket to the Science Museum of Minnesota, but they don't bring in their proof of being poor to our counter. We work with 100 United Way agencies to allow them to sell that ticket for a dollar, which pride is what that dollar is. And you come across our transit with the same ticket that anyone else would bring in. Minnesota is blessed with being first in many great areas. We're among the top one or two in science and mathematics achievement. We're doing great work in our high school graduation rates, but we're not number one in everything. We are sadly near the bottom in our description of the achievement gap between black and white students. We're sadly 46th in the nation in the availability of out-of-school and after-school programming. Worse yet, perhaps, we're 42nd in the nation in our utilization of those programs, which means of the very few programs we have, we're overtaxing them. But because of the investment you've made in the Science Museum of Minnesota, we've turned that into great opportunities where 100 United Way agencies serving 52,000 families can provide them with out-of-school programming, family programming, after-school programs, small group programs. That's what we're doing with your investment. We're supporting 21 districts in major ways through Science House, 74 counties in our outreach program, taking care of the waters of the Mississippi, being recognized by the Environmental Protection Agency in the only national award they give as the Friend of the Gulf Award. Our St. Croix Watershed Research Station preserves the health and well-being of Minnesotans in such a way as to feed to the health and well-being of the entire nation through the Mississippi. No agency has ever won that award so far from the Gulf of Mexico. We're proud to be number one in that. We're proud to be able to attract more than $6 million in federal grants, making us the science museum with the most federal grants from the National Science Foundation in the entire United States, more than the combined totals of the Smithsonian. We are taking the investment that you make for a respectful facility, one with clean floors and clean windows, and making it a vehicle of pride for Minnesota and of opportunities. We're delighted that we don't have to worry about cutting back on what we consider essential services, because what I would fear is if a cut to the Science Museum meant a cut to 100 United Way agencies' abilities to serve thousands and thousands of families, or a cut for our teachers and school districts' ability to provide subsidized field trips, or a cut for our teachers to be able to get their training and professional development. I hope we have been the kinds of stewards of your investment that you would be proud of. And I know that as we look at building a workforce for the future and a place which brings corporate America to invest in this state, that we're providing the infrastructure they will point to with pride for a clean environment, well-trained teachers, engaged students, and someone who cares about those who are without in ways that provide them with dignity and opportunity. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I will be very happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Jelly. We appreciate it. Ms. Rainey, do you have anything to add?
Not if there aren't any questions, no.
Okay, Representative Houston.
You know, as I was looking at their statistics, about 37 of 87 counties sending school groups, and no, they come to the Capitol and many other places. Do we do anything to facilitate overnight stays, for example, you know, good hotel rates or something, so that if they wanted to package 2 days, I mean, we probably have enough sites, you know, just key museums.
They camp out overnight at the Science Museum, Representative Houseman.
That is sometimes an option.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, night at the museum happens at the Science Museum of Minnesota. We no longer allow the students to sleep with the mummy because they believe he comes alive. And it's just too much bad science to dispel. However, We do provide overnight camp-ins to over 4,000 students every year from all across the state of Minnesota, and we also have a program with the Convention and Visitors Bureau to provide lower-cost housing for groups that would like to come and not sleep on a floor.
Do you have shower facilities?
Not, except for chaperones.
Ah. Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jolly, I was going to follow you outside and ask you this, but I may as well just now. What are your evening hours, and when does Van Gogh leave?
Madam Chair, Representative, the film festival ends on Thursday, when we will open what will be, I think, the greatest pride of Minnesota. And if I may take this softball moment and thank you. Imagine 2,000 years ago, a group of Israelite scholars secreted away their most prized possessions, the foundation of Western civilizations, their codes, their laws, the first written copy of the Bible, in absolute faith that it would serve a future they would not see. 2,000 years later, the year Israel is founded as a nation, that faith is answered with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These scrolls are the greatest example of laying the groundwork for the expression of culture, civilization, and law. And they are only understood and amplified. They are only read through the greatest application of science that you can imagine. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls with the treasures of Qumran, with artifacts from the Second Temple period, joined together with the most recent handwritten Bible, the St. John's Bible, and will be the only venue in the world for these scrolls opening on the day we close Van Gogh. And so I hope you'll see Van Gogh quickly, because you'll need to pack your bag and get ready to stand in line for the treasures that we've brought from the Israeli Antiquities Authority. Thank you.
Evening hours?
Excuse me. Our evening hours will be until 10 o'clock when we open the scrolls. And right now they are until 6 o'clock through Wednesday and 9 o'clock on Thursday. Will you correct me for the exact time?
Ms. Rainey.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, for the record, I'm Brenda Rainey, Director of Government Relations at the Science Museum. We are open three nights a week until 9, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. And just as a point of reference, in a sampling, a large sampling of museums around the country and in the Twin Cities area, we're the only museum to be open three nights a week, and we are open far more hours than most museums you'll find.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have a grave problem to solve tonight. We have to find $2,500,000 to cut. There are eight, Dr. Jolly, there are eight line items on our spreadsheets that have been zeroed out. Completely zeroed out. Those eight items, because if we followed the recommendation to zero them out, we would no longer be eligible, or they would no longer be eligible to receive millions of dollars of federal money. In meetings with the Republican caucus and the Democratic caucus at an earlier time, people have indicated to us that we didn't want to zero anybody out. That we did not want to be put in the position down the road of having to supplant rather than supplement with the 3/8 money. But tonight we're not talking about the 3/8 money. The 3/8 money has nothing to do with the spreadsheet that we're going to be working with tonight. it was my hope that by refreshing our memories on that we were carrying the accounts of the seven or eight programs from the various agencies that were not invited to be cut, that maybe there would be some more of the attitude that we're all in this together. We know that you have to a serious problem and you have to cut and we'll take our fair share kind of thing. But I didn't hear that tonight either. But I did have hopes that maybe we could get $4,000 or $5,000 tonight. But I didn't hear that either. I invite you to think about that as we proceed now as a committee and as people in the audience that want to participate. Ms. Anton, will you see that the spreadsheets are passed out? Committee worksheet version 1. $2.5 million is the target that we have to arrive at. I would like us to work in groups of 4 or 5 and put your names at the top of a sheet and indicate in some way what you'd be willing to cut from where. I would like for the audience people that not all the television people get together, not all the arts people get together and just do your arts one or your television one, but mix up and work very similarly to the way that you did last year and work very similarly to the way that you did last year or in the very same groups, although I seem to have lost a lot of people tonight. But let's see what you come up with and say 5 people to a group. So I should get 3 groups anyway, or 2 groups anyway, from whoever's here. That means you'll have to talk to each other. That means you'll have to remember some of the things that were said last year about how much we have. But I don't think that we should go on the premise that we're going to recommend that any group be left out. However, that being said, do not make any changes in the library thing because the library money is being carried in K-12. The library money has been modified by the maintenance of effort language that was agreed upon last year, and counties are applying to be recertified or whatever the librarian, Ms. Miller, talked about last week. And for 2009 and for 2010, those applications are just coming in. Local government aids have affected the library's revenues, and we never ever did hear completely the total state amount of money that was going into the libraries. And we will be talking about libraries later on in the year because the library legislative audit report will be out on March 17th. So the 2.5 does not include the libraries.